This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Have you ever heard of Pig 05049? Well, this pig stars in a talk on the TED.com site. It's by a Dutch researcher named Christine Mindelsma. She's traced the afterlife of pig 05049, and guess what? It ended up in 185 products. Think cement, bread dough, house paint, beer filters, dinner plates, low-fat butter, heart valves, and meat. Her point is, we have no idea of all of the ways an animal is used. I mean, who knew? Well, stay with us. There's more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Today we're celebrating great eating past, present, and future. For example, as in Italy 150 years ago, or in seizing a maple syrup moment. The sap is running as I speak. And then how about what to plant to eat this summer? And then there's the work of a man named Scott Peacock. Now, Scott's a Southerner. He's a chef and a food writer who grew up in a small town in Alabama. He loves to work with people who have lived longer than most of us. He worked with the legendary Southern cook Edna Lewis before she passed, and now he's doing a documentary film. He calls it The Alabama Project. Scott, we have not talked in ages. It is good to have you back with us.
Oh, it's great to talk to you.
So what's The Alabama Project?
Well, the Alabama Project is basically, as you said, I'm from Alabama, and about a year and a half ago, I started traveling around the state looking for the oldest living Alabamians I could find in most instances and interviewing them about their earliest food memories.
So what did you discover?
The project is wonderful because we start out talking about breakfast, and it leads to a great many things. And, you know, as Miss Lewis used to say, you can't talk about Southern food without talking about Southern people. So you get these little pictures of the small details that give you this glimpse of pre-modern life in Alabama and a real glimpse into, you know, not just what people were eating, but how people were living and what it was like nearly 100 years ago, and in some cases 100 years ago or 105 or 107 years ago.
Could we hear one of these interviews?
I'd love to. The first clip you're going to hear is a woman in Montgomery, Alabama, in her 80s named Dodgie Schaffer. And she's a woman of great style and substance, was wonderful friends with Scottie Fitzgerald, the daughter of F. Scott and Zelda Fitzgerald, Zelda being from Montgomery. In fact, she has Zelda's signed copy of The Joy of Cooking. And she is quite a character and quite a storyteller and very intelligent. And, you know, in the South, we have certain food traditions that are revered. And Dodgie sort of tramples on one of those.
In my opinion, cheese straws are vastly overrated. They are an institution, of course, in the South. You can't have a wedding. You can't have a funeral. You can't have a guest. You can't have anything without cheese straws. I can. I have made cheese straws. It's not worth the effort, in my opinion. I don't know where cheese straws came from. Where did they come from? I think it's one of those things like the boll weevil that they brought in, and it just got all over, spread all over.
Oh, she sounds like a character.
Everyone talks about cheese straws. Almost everyone talks about cheese straws, and they're a hallmark food. And everything Dodgie said, I mean, you can't have a social occasion without them. Someone gets married, someone's born,
right,
someone dies,
right.
Someone shows up with cheese straws. So, Dodgie's very, very forthcoming and very funny. And very aware of it, and sends me emails signed Our Lady of the Cheese Straws.
You know, when I think of the South, I also think of cornbread.
Yes, yes. Cornbread, a great delicacy of the South, and also much more than that. I mean, it's a staple, and once was a very, very central part of the diet, even when I was growing up. But back in the childhoods of these people that I've been interviewing, it was survival, in fact. And people, generally speaking, certainly in rural areas, they grew corn, and then they would take it to the grist mill and have it ground into cornmeal. So it was readily available. Biscuits, which are a legendary Southern food, were not always available because you had to buy flour, and people, frankly, didn't always have the money to buy the flour. Mm-hmm. So I think this next clip we're going to hear is Ollie Glass. And Ollie Glass is a wonderful woman from my hometown of Hartford, Alabama. She's African-American. She will be 100 this August. She still lives alone. She drives to the post office and is very active in her senior citizens group. And she's a very strong, yet very gentle person. And she's a model to me of how to live a life of sometimes great difficulty and still remain warm and open. She worked, incidentally, during segregation. She worked for 20 years as a cook at the black high school in Hartford. She also lived in New York for 20 years. She did a lot of things. You can do a lot of things in 100 years. And then one thing that she talked about addressing the importance of cornbread was how that at breakfast time, that before they had their regular breakfast, everyone would eat a little bit of leftover cornbread from the night before. And that was to sort of help fill up before they ate their biscuit, because there might not be enough biscuit to satisfy everyone. Let's listen to this. Can you tell me about cornbread a little bit?
Oh, they'd make that cornbread, you know, get that cornmeal. You had to sift it then. You don't sift the meal now. But back then you sifted to get the husk out of it and make it up with a little salt and water. And then breakfast time, we had to eat a piece of cornbread before we ate that biscuit to help fill up. So we just had a good time and had milk to drink, because she'd go out and milk the cow.
Scott, she sounds wonderful.
She's a remarkable person.
So is there one more person you'd like us to meet?
There is. Jim Murphy was my father's school teacher and basketball coach in his late 80s in Slocum, Alabama. And he talked to us about a great many things about growing up and the importance of food. But it was an especially poignant moment when he talked about the connections that are made through the kitchen, and in reference to his wife who had passed on several years before him. Listen to this.
Little things influence you all your life. Certain things that mean absolutely nothing will pop up every day just about it that you remember. Just for instance, now this is just really important, but I never, over at the sink, I never wash a butcher knife. But what, I don't think of my wife. I've seen her stand there and where the blade come out of the handle, you know. She was very careful that there was nothing left right there. So every time I wash that butcher knife, well, I think of that. And so that's where you'll be with little things that'll influence your life. And they don't, but they're a reminder of something that all the time.
Does that make you sad or happy?
It just makes me feel, I guess, still connected.
You know, Scott, this is all about those connections, as you said, that happened in the kitchen.
So moving. It still moves me. And this clip is particularly poignant and moving because Mr. Murphy just recently passed away himself.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Indeed. And I would treasure that time that we spent, and I'm so grateful to have his story recorded.
Scott, we're going to check in with you again. This is quite a project. Thanks for sharing it.
Oh, it's my great pleasure. Thank you, Lynn.
Chef Scott Peacock is co-author with Edna Lewis of the book The Gift of Southern Cooking. Now, somehow he felt a cheese straw recipe would be appropriate here, and you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, register for our monthly book giveaway. Now, this month, it's Chef Gabrielle Hamilton's memoir, Blood, Bones, and Butter. Check it out. There's a lot up there. SplendidTable.org. You know what it's like when you've been on a trip with lousy food. And what's worse is when you come home and you discover that just down the block was the best barbecue in the state and you missed it. Well, if you follow Jane and Michael Stern, I can guarantee that that will never happen again. Jane, Michael, good to have you back.
Great to be here, Lynn.
So where have you been?
We have been in Los Angeles eating stacks of fabulous pancakes served with a pitcher of syrup and a pitcher of melted butter to pour atop them.
That's very classy.
It's very classy.
Are you going to tell Lynn where we're doing this?
Well, yes, but I was about to say it's very classy, but it's in, I don't want to say it's not a classy place, but it's in the classic coffee shop environment of Dupar's, which is a restaurant at the farmer's market, open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can get these pancakes at any time, as well as all the traditional coffee shop hot meals and breakfasts and fresh donuts and stuff. But these pancakes, let me tell you, there's nothing extraordinary about them. They look like regular pancakes, but they're, you know, made from scratch. They're fluffy. They're the kind of pancake with the slightest bit of crispness to its outside, so you can almost crack it with a fork. But the moment you crack it, there's that tender, soft, fluffy inside. Pour on the melted butter, pour on the syrup, and you are in pancake heaven.
You know, Dupar's really is a shrine. It's one of the classic Los Angeles eateries, along with Philippe's, the original, or Musso and Frank's. Dupar's has been around for a very long time, and I think the coffee shop cuisine, you know, where every day there's a special Wednesday's pot roast,
right.
Thursday's
yeah.
liver and onions, you know, that's a really an overlooked and underrated type of food. And people associate that with diners, but it's really more coffee shops.
Which farmer's market in L.A.?
This is the one on West 3rd Street.
The one that's been there forever and ever
yes,
and ever.
Yes, it's the one that's been there forever. There are actually a couple of other Dupar's in the Los Angeles area, and I think there's even one in San Diego. This is the original one, and it's great to go there at really odd hours because you know, it's the kind of place where you see people who are ending an evening and also see people who are beginning their day at the same time.
And a lot of celebrities kind of undercover.
Yes.
Oh, this sounds like a great place to hang out.
It is. It's the total L.A. experience from the 1950s.
So does it look like an old-time coffee shop with the leatherette booths and that kind of thing?
Leatherette booths, uniformed waitresses, thick dishware, the smell of coffee and sizzling
and
hash in the kitchen.
Wonderfully out-of-fashion things. I mean, pot pies, they're coming back, but Welsh rarebit, corned beef hash, turkey with all the trimmings, coconut custard pie. I mean, it's, you know, the term comfort food is so incredibly overused and overdone, but this really is the best of American comfort food.
You know, there's this myth that we never had very good food in the United States until, you know, what, 1970, 19 whatever.
Oh, and please.
Well, places like this prove the point.
Yeah, I forget which celebrity chef
invented American
cuisine. Yeah, said that it wasn't until 1979 when he invented American cuisine. There is nothing to eat.
He shall go nameless at the moment. But this sounds like a great place. Guys,
it is.
You.
It's a real piece of Los Angeles.
Thank you.
Bye, Liz.
Bye.
The Stern's Tome of the Moment is 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Now, you can get their finds of the moment on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, those Dupar's pancakes started me thinking of savory pancakes. For instance, Dory Greenspan, the food writer, shared a recipe for us from France for Swiss chard pancakes. Now, you can find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back in a moment with the Italy almost no one knows and the DIY of maple syrup. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Did you know that Italy did not exist until 1861? I mean, the pizza and the pasta were there, but not a unified country. The peninsula was called Italy. But all of its dukedoms and papal states and kingdoms never had any interest in joining hands for more than about 15 minutes. Think herding cats. Well, Italian culinary historian Fred Plotkin joins us. Fred, welcome.
Thank you.
So, Fred, what brought Italy together and why at that time?
What brought Italy together in 1861 was Giuseppe Verdi, who had written nationalistic operas telling Italians to throw off foreign domination.
Huh.
And then Giuseppe Garibaldi, the George Washington of Italy, who traveled around the whole peninsula inciting people to join the Italian Republic, the new Italian Republic. They say that he slept everywhere. I call myself Garibaldi with a fork because I've eaten everywhere.
Was there a change in Italian food because of the unification?
Well, the main changes is that when you have a country with nominally an administrative head, in this case in Turin was the first capital, they built railways. They tried to teach people Italian instead of their common dialects. And the result was that unevenly Italy grew. The Northwest, which is to say Genoa, Turin, Milan, developed first. They laid down railway tracks. Near Genoa is Onelia, and Onelia was the great olive oil-producing town of that part of the world. They built railway tracks into the factory where it was produced, so oil was shipped directly to people in Torino, in Turin, and Milan, where they never used oil before. So suddenly, the cooking fat changed, and when the cooking fat changes, so too does the way we prepare food. If in Emilia-Romagna you use lard and use butter in Lombardy, then suddenly things are changing. And with that, other vegetables, fruits, meat started traveling about the country that people had never seen before.
So how did people react to this? Because I'm thinking, you know, Italy was so deeply regional for thousands of years where you ate the way your part of Italy ate. How did people react?
Well, mixed, because they had some identity through their foods, but they also were joining the nation. And the areas that developed financially first, the Northwest, not the Northeast, the way people often think, suddenly had enough money to purchase these items, and they began to experiment. Only in the North were there restaurants at that time, and some trattorias. In the center and the South, people catered in a different way. And therefore, these ingredients began to enter the restaurants. In Turin, there's a restaurant called the Cambio, which is where a lot of the nation of Italy was born. And in that restaurant, which you can still visit today, they had typical dishes of Turin, but began to introduce products from elsewhere in the country to give what they called a palcoscenico, in other words, a window, a portrait of the rest of the new Italian nation by presenting their foods at the Cambio restaurant.
At this time, were people able to read cookbooks? I mean, were there cookbooks?
Not really. In Italy, there's the tradition of writing down family recipes in Bibles, in little books that were kept at home. Among people who could write. Remember, at that time, 80% of Italians were illiterate. But those who could write wrote things down. The first fellow to do any collection of recipes from around the peninsula was Pellegrino Artusi. And in the last third of the 19th century, he liked to drop in on housewives and ask them what they cook. I did that, too. That's how I got my recipes. But I didn't seduce them all. He tried to. He went after every woman whose kitchen he entered. And in so doing, gathered recipes for the nation. And he put them in a book, which he called The Science and Art of Eating. And it didn't come out until the early 20th century. So I view Artusi's work as important documentation rather than the spreading at that time of recipes.
Mm-hmm.
People did not follow recipes. They ate what they knew.
So for you, what survives from that period, from the middle part of the 19th century, that's still there today? What dish do you love from that era?
Well, to me, what's so notable is not just what survived, but what grew. So that canning, tinning, as it was called in Italy, suddenly came about. And the tomato, which really just lived in the South, especially around Naples, suddenly began to travel.
And in every can, they would have peeled tomatoes, a little water, a pinch of salt, and always a beautiful basil leaf that said, here, this is where this comes from the sun. And the tomato began to enter dishes around the country. Now, if I were to name dishes that are historic from that time, my favorite is called La Financiera, which is something from Turin, which is, we could put it bluntly, a big fry-up of different organ meats and vegetables, and it combined everything that was available and left. Now, it's a dish that they still make today. It's a bit out of fashion because people think that's heavy eating. It's a lot of frying.
Uh-huh.
But if you delicately fry in olive oil, by the way, even though that was not an olive oil zone,
right,
you still have something very delicate. Before that, people used walnut oil in that part of the country.
Fred, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Fred Plotkin is author of Italy for the Gourmet Traveler. Now, Italy's exact anniversary is March 17th, so St. Patrick is going to have to wait until next year. Now, uncork the Chianti and make a dish from 1861. Fred nicks that recipe for Financiere because he explained it was going to be a full day at the stove. Instead, you can find Fred's recipe for tagliatelle that's tossed with butter, tomatoes, veal, pork, and chicken livers. It's really delicious. In Italian, it's called Macaroncelli alla Campofiglione, and it's on the website, splendidtable.org. If you're toying with the idea of planting some seeds for your summer suppers, there's a top 10 list you may want to take a look at. Organic Gardening Magazine did their yearly test garden, and they picked the best of the best. Well, Doug Hall is the magazine's senior editor, and he joins us. Doug, welcome.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
So, Doug, what standards does a plant have to live up to make that list?
In our test garden, we trial from 50 to 60 different vegetable varieties every year. We look at some varieties that are brand new and others that maybe are reintroduced heirlooms, and a few old tried-and-true favorites that maybe have simply not caught on with the gardening public. We're always looking for a vegetable variety that will outperform its peers or comparable vegetables in flavor, or in the health or productivity of the plant.
So what would be a handful of this top 10 that you would recommend?
With home gardeners, tomatoes are always the number one vegetable. So we had included 8 different tomato varieties in our test garden last year, and we did a blind taste testing in the office. And I threw in one grocery store tomato just to make sure everyone was paying attention. Predictably, the grocery store tomato did not fool anyone, and it came out on the bottom of the rankings. The one that came out on the top was quite a surprise to me because it was a paste tomato.
Oh.
A tomato that is marketed for cooking, and it's a San Marzano type hybrid, a new variety called San Marzano Gigante 3. We got our seed from Territorial Seed Company in Oregon. And I really did not expect a paste tomato to outscore the salad tomatoes or the cherry tomatoes.
Yeah,
oftentimes,
yeah,
the cherry tomatoes win taste contests. But this particular paste tomato, the tasters described it as having a very rich, mellow, and smoky flavor.
So it's the San Marzano Gigante...
Three.
Okay.
Yeah, kind of an unwieldy name.
Right, right. Did you test basils?
We did. Of course, Genovese basil is the standard sweet basil that most gardeners swear by.
Right.
We tried a new open-pollinated variety called Aton. We got our seed from High Mowing Organic Seeds, and it has the same flavor that you would expect from basil, but it had the advantage of having a longer harvest season. When a basil plant starts to flower, that's often the point at which the taste changes.
Yeah,
the leaves start becoming
does.
A little bit bitter. Pinching it back helps a little bit to keep new leaves coming, but basically flowering time is controlled by day length, so the gardener really has very little control over it. So this Aton variety turned out to be a much longer producing basil in our test garden.
What about the salad category?
salad greens are such an easy vegetable to produce in the garden. For one thing, they don't require the full sun exposure that most vegetables do. So if you've got a shady spot, salad greens and leaf lettuces are a really good choice. They also can be grown in containers. We grew several different kinds, but the one that really stood out from the crowd was a variety called Sea of Red, and it's sold by Renee's Garden. It's a red or almost burgundy-colored leaf lettuce, and very shiny look to the leaves that was quite appealing.
How does it taste?
It has a very mild flavor. Again, it had a nice long harvest period of time in the garden before it became bitter.
How about green beans?
Green beans are another great summer vegetable. I remember my grandmother growing Kentucky Wonder pole beans. And pole beans are a vining bean that have a reputation for producing all summer long. Bush beans, on the other hand, usually have a shorter period of harvest, 3 or 4 weeks. But they take less space in the garden and they're easier to grow. We found a bush bean variety called Bonanza, and it comes from Burpee, that had the long harvest season of a pole bean. It also was the most attractive bean. It had just a really uniform, thin filet bean look that it maintained throughout the heat of summer.
And the taste was good?
Oh, excellent, yes. No fiber, no strings, just nice, tender, crisp pods.
Doug, thank you for this.
Well, Lynn, it's been my pleasure to talk with you.
Doug Hall is senior editor at Organic Gardening Magazine. Now, you can find his top picks for this year's seeds on the website, splendidtable.org.
I love you.
Well, the lines are open. We are taking your calls. It's 800-537-5252 or email us at splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see. We have got Katie. We have Cheryl on the line from Katy, Texas. Cheryl, I mixed that up.
It happens all the time, Lynn.
Katie from Cheryl, Texas. So, Cheryl, what's on your mind?
Well, Lynn, my question is about pork stock. Anytime I fabricate or roast a chicken, I always save the carcass for stock, and I do the same whenever I have like a whole fish frame. But the other day, I was working on menus for my clients, and I was going over my shopping list, and it struck me that I have never encountered a recipe that called for, or neither have I seen on the grocery store shelves, pork stock. So my question of you is, what's the deal with pork stock?
Now, you say clients. Are you a personal chef?
I'm a personal chef.
Mm-hmm. What a great job.
It's fabulous.
Does it really work for you?
It really does. It's a good skill set match, and my clients love me because they're busy and they don't want to eat out. They want home-cooked meals. Their allergy issues or gluten intolerance issues, you know. It's just, it's a win-win.
It sounds like it. Okay, pork stock.
Back to pork stock.
If we're going to talk classic French cooking, okay, the only place pork stock shows up is in charcuterie, you know, pâtés, all that kind of, you know, sausages. And I think one of the reasons is that A, it can be very fatty, and B, it's very sweet.
Oh.
You know, if you think about it, pork meat has a really delicious sweetness to it. Mm-hmm. Now, that's classical French cooking, and that's fine when you're in the upper echelon of, you know, the highest of the high.
Right.
For we folks, okay?
We mere mortals.
We mere mortals. I cannot think of anything better than a stash of bones, you know, and scraps in a bag in the freezer. That includes the chicken and, you know, the bits of pork and the bones and whatever, and you go from there.
Okay.
That's, I would mix it in. I would do it on its own. I mean, you're going to, if you're worried about the fat aspect,
First of all, I don't think once you trim some of that fat away, you have any more fat in a pork broth than you have in a chicken broth or a beef broth.
Oh, and I'd just clarify that afterwards anyway.
Yeah, and also if you know, the big trick with stock making broth is you don't let it really bubble. You have it go
right.
Blurp, and then you count to five, and it goes blurp again. And that way the fat doesn't really kind of emulsify into the liquid. But the point here is that you can get wonderful flavor. And, I mean, if you think of roasted pork bones, if you've got some bones left over from pork roast or anything you're doing, and you run them into a really hot oven for a short time until they get brown and crusty, then put them in the pot. Mm-hmm. You're gonna be drinking that stuff through a straw. It's going to be so good. So I would do pork stock, or I would mix it in with other things.
Okay.
I mean, you don't have to be a purist here. Unless,
and that'll cut the sweetness.
And you know, the other thing is that one of the great ways of doing it, too, I always add wine to my stocks, especially when I'm making them from the carcasses and that kind of thing, because it opens up, alcohol opens up flavors that other things do not. And I put in wine, a few drops of fish sauce, you know, some white wine.
Right.
A few shots of fish sauce and a little bit of tomato paste, both of which have a lot of umami.
Right.
Yeah. They're going to open up even more flavor. And you're not going to really taste them. You know, they're going to be there, but you're not going to know they're there. And you'll have a stock that'll just, they'll kiss your apron.
Fabulous. You know, now I don't have to waste the pork bones.
You don't have to waste the pork bones. You see?
Hey.
You know? Save it all.
Thank you.
Put it to work.
You bet. Mystery solved.
You got it.
Thanks, Lynn. Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Harry's on the line from Columbus. Harry, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I'm currently trying to play around with making my own ketchup, and I'm running into a real consistency problem with it.
In the sense what? It's too runny or too thick?
No. This is really, really strange. What I'm doing is I'm combining tomato sauce, paste, cider vinegar, balsamic vinegar, some spices, and some onion powder, mixing it together, and then putting it in the refrigerator. Now, initially, it's very, very smooth, just like bottled ketchup.
Right.
But within about 4 days' time, it starts to congeal and get rather almost gelatinous and what I would call chunky and funky.
How strange.
And
so
I have
got
no
balsamic vinegar, tomato paste, onion powder. What else is in there?
Tomato sauce. A pinch of cinnamon, cloves, and allspice, and brown sugar.
Harry, I'm stumped.
I wondered if there wasn't something in the onion powder, some sort of anti-caking agent or something that they may put in onion powder
That's very, very possible. And I don't use much onion powder, so I can't remember the label. I usually memorize labels. But I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sort of caking action that's going on from the onion powder. How about this? How about throwing some fresh onions into it instead of the onion powder?
Well, that makes sense.
And also, you're going to get a brighter flavor.
Oh, okay. I'll give that a try.
Yeah, because, you know, some onion powders can really go funky. Also, I mean, just from a taste point of view, like, you know, certain onion powders and garlic powders, they just don't, they're not happy tasting.
Right.
But I would try, do a tiny batch and do it with fresh onion.
I'll give that a try.
Give it 4 days and see what it looks like. I'll bet you it looks better.
Okay. Will do.
All right. Harry, take care.
Thanks so much, Lynn.
Bye. 800-537-5252. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the latest flavor in toothpaste? Well, we're going to be back with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to get back to talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook. Give us a call at 800-537-5252 or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the latest flavor in toothpaste? Well, the answer is bacon flavor. Now, this is for real. Honest. I mean, nothing like beating the breakfast rush. nothing like exhaling at that morning meeting, and nothing like offending your vegan friends. But then again, can't you see the ad? Bacon breath. Not just for food crazies anymore. Okay, back to your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. Anything goes. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Okay, let's see who's up. We've got Carletta on the phone from Los Angeles. Carletta, hi. What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about black-eyed peas. I'm used to buying them in the can, and then I wanted to move to using the dried ones.
Right.
They're never really tender. No matter how long I cut them, they're just kind of hard still.
Let me ask you, are you soaking them first?
Yes.
First of all, you know, the longer a dried pea or bean has sat around, the longer it takes to cook. And it keeps, I mean, they'll keep forever. People have opened up tombs, you know, in the pyramids and found dried beans that you could then cook. I mean, these things will really have a very long life, but they'll just, you know, it'll take another 500 years to cook those beans. But this is the thing about the peas. This is what I'm wondering. First of all, are you buying them in a place where there's a fair amount of turnover?
Ah, that's a good point. I'm not really sure where I got these. I mean, there's so many different places in Los Angeles to get them. And
oh, of course.
That I got these at an Asian market. So maybe that is why maybe they don't turn over.
That may be because I don't know that they're that popular in Asian cooking. And it's not that I want you to waste money and throw them out, but this may sort of be, you know, be wasting a lot of time that for a buck, whatever, that you may have be wasting.
Right.
You can go to a supermarket where, you know, there's just a lot more people buying stuff and pick up a pound of them. And try them, because the way you want to do this is there's two ways of soaking beans. One is that you pour boiling water over them and just let them sit at room temp for an hour or two.
That's what I was using.
Yeah. Or the other way is that you put cold water over them and you stick them in the fridge overnight. And you achieve more or less the same thing both ways. And then what you do is you drain off that water. Okay, you put fresh water, you put them in a pot with fresh water, and maybe you have about an inch or 2 inches of water over them so that they're not going to dry out or burn. And you cook them at a really, really slow, slow simmer. You do not add anything acidic to them. Like you wouldn't add wine, you wouldn't add tomatoes, you wouldn't add anything acidic because acidic things stop the cooking of the beans. And I don't know if maybe you've been cooking them with something that may have an effect on them.
Right, because I've been making like a sofrito, and so it has tomato in there, so that's probably it.
Now, you can cook them with the sofrito, but leave out the tomato.
Okay.
Because
okay.
I use a trick from Steve Sando. He does mail order heirloom beans. And he uses a trick where at the bottom of the pot, he's going to cook the beans in. He heats olive oil and he just sautés some celery, carrot, and onion. You do that sauté or your sofrito, okay? That's fine. Just don't put tomatoes in it.
Excellent.
And by the way, that makes the beans something you want to eat with a spoon right out of the pot. No question. I mean, I love to start that way because anything I do with those beans afterward, you know, after my initial meal of them, they're going to already be great. So I have no problem. They're flavored. So try that. I think the tomato is what's giving you the problem.
Excellent.
Okay.
Thank you.
You are welcome, ma'am. Enjoy the beans.
Oh, definitely.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or follow us on Twitter or shoot us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org. Kelly is on the line from Flower Mound, Texas. Kelly, what do you want to talk about?
I would like to talk about acid.
I beg your pardon.
I know. I hear a lot on cooking programs about adding acidity to dishes or limes or lemons or something like that, but I don't really know what that is doing aside from what I hear, which is that it adds brightness. But I wanted to know a little bit more about when and how you should add that to dishes that you're making.
Okay. Well, you know, acid is something that, as you said, it brightens things. It enlivens them. And a couple of tricks to remember when you're working with it in cooking, whether it's vinegar, you know, or it's lime or lemon or whatever, is that when you cook it, it fades. Now, the different acids behave differently. For instance, if you take vinegar and let's say you cook vinegar into, you know, the browned onions that you begin a sauce with, right? Mm-hmm. So in some words, if you cook it in at the very beginning of cooking, it fades and it doesn't taste quite acidic. It doesn't taste very strong, but it will give you a nice backdrop.
Okay.
But if you want to get that real bright, fresh kick, okay, you always add acid at the end.
And does it matter what kind of acid you add?
I think it comes down to what flavor you want.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, if you go into the vinegar world, you could just go on forever because you've got everything from palm vinegar to balsamic to malt, you know, to sherry to wine. And then usually that's a pretty high acidic kick. When you look at citrus fruits like lemon and lime, which are two really great distinctive flavors, those are going to give things more of a tropical feel. But I'll give you an instance. The other night I roasted a chicken and I did it really simply. I just rubbed it with some olive oil, put some salt and pepper on it, and I roasted it. And it was really delicious. But I wanted, when I served it, I just wanted a little more. And so I just squeezed some lemon over it.
Okay.
And the whole thing came alive.
Are there certain types of dishes that you wouldn't want to do that with as far as savory dishes that you should avoid doing that?
I think you got to think about what you want to taste. So, for instance, pasta with tomato sauce? Nah.
Okay.
But pasta with some shaved cheese on it, let's say, and garlic and a little hot chili, I think a squirt of lemon on that would be just fabulous.
And what do you do if you go too far? Like you added too much. Is there something to balance it back?
Well, fat will balance it, but you don't want to go that route unless, you know, I mean, sometimes you don't want to go that route of sprinkling with oil or whatever.
Okay.
I think the thing you want to do is eat it and know that you've just learned a lesson.
Okay. Try not to go there to begin with.
Right. But the places to go with acid is fatty things.
Okay.
You know, like that really great marbled steak. I know this will be sacrilege to all the great barbecue people, you know, who worship barbecue. But you do great pulled pork and you just sprinkle a little teeny bit of vinegar on that.
Mm-hmm.
Your mouth will water.
You do realize I'm in Texas, so pork barbecue, you know.
I'm sorry. All right. I'm sorry. Beef barbecue.
But we'll go with beef.
Okay, with beef. But beef, which is generally, you know, pretty robust and full-flavored, you do a teeny bit of vinegar on that.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be fabulous.
Well, great.
Okay? So think, you know, whatever's fatty, whatever's rich, whatever you want sparkle from.
All right, that works.
Okay?
I appreciate your help, Lynn. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for a great question.
All right.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us. Follow us on Twitter. Check us out on Facebook. Call us, 800-537-5252. Kristen is on the line from Ann Arbor. Kristen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I have a question about curry sauces made with yogurt.
Uh-huh.
I have this problem that the yogurt tends to separate or get an almost curdled or like grainy appearance in the curry sauce when I add it.
When are you adding the yogurt?
Well, usually I start by frying up the spices and onion or garlic or whatever is in the curry.
Right, right.
And some tomato. And then when that's getting kind of nice and thick and fragrant, that's when I start adding the yogurt. And I've tried doing it a little bit at a time or all at once, and it doesn't seem to change. I somehow always end up getting this kind of grainy texture in the yogurt.
Well, there's a trick to yogurt. And, you know, the basic idea of curry is, of making a sauce a curry, is you have a combination of aromatic vegetables, usually onion and maybe garlic, maybe ginger. But the idea is you sauté that and then you cook into that spices and other ingredients. And you cook and you cook and you cook until the oils actually start to separate. You know, the fat you've cooked in actually starts to separate from the other ingredients and you develop this fabulous flavor. Now, when you cook with yogurt, now this depends on the recipe, of course, but what I found is this. I cook it all the way in.
Mm-hmm.
In so many words, it's going to curdle as you cook it down, but you just keep cooking it and you want it to kind of disappear and you'll get that soft tang and you'll get that lovely enrichment of the yogurt. And then what you can do is, at the very end of cooking, you add yogurt to the dish and you don't cook it at all. the yogurt's the refreshment of the dish. So the yogurt goes in at two levels.
Okay.
Because once you heat yogurt, it's going to separate. It's the nature, you know, it's the nature of the beast.
Sure.
And also, by the way, separated yogurt is just fine. I mean, it may not look wonderful, but boy, you know, you're still going to get all that great taste. But
yeah, it tastes fine.
but try that idea of cooking it all the way in, just the way you would be cooking those onions until they're limp, you know, and then they start to maybe even brown. And then you add the spices that you're using or any of the other aromatics and you cook that some more. Add the yogurt. Let that cook and let it cook and let it cook. And then you add whatever it is, you know, your vegetables or your meat or whatever. Let them cook. And at the very end, daub the yogurt on. It's
going to
be – it'll be just fabulous. You'll get that tang, especially if the curry is really rich in flavor and maybe has some spice to it, you know, some real heat from chilies.
Yeah. Oh, wonderful. I can't wait to try it. So be a little more patient.
Yeah. And it takes patience because, you know, you want to add it and then you see it turn into this mess. You know, I know what you mean. Let it go. It's gonna disappear. Don't worry.
Okay. Wonderful.
Okay.
I can't wait to try it. Thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for a great dinner idea. Take care, Kristen. Bye.
Bye.
You know, this idea of cooking with yogurt, it's really a great way to cook. And I like whole milk yogurt. Now, I know that defeats the whole low-fat thing, but it's so rich that a little bit of it tastes like sour cream. And when you make tomato soup, for instance, you just stir a little bit of that whole milk yogurt in at the very end. It is just delicious. It tastes like cream, but it has that tang. And you put a little bit of that yogurt on steamed asparagus and grilled scallions. Okay, I'm going to stop now. You can reach us, 800-537-5252, or send us an email, splendidtable.org. Every year, there is this little window when the maples across the country wake up. Their sap starts running, and the game is on. Real maple syrup is a thing of beauty. Now, one naturalist who got hooked on this stuff is Tim Hurd. He's done a meticulous guide called Maple Sugar from Sap to Syrup. Tim, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, you know, before we get to how you do it, how do you pick your tree?
Well, there are actually quite a few different kinds of maple trees, and all of them have sweet sap, but not in the same concentrations. The one with the most, of course, is the sugar maple.
Right.
But red maples, black maples, silver maples, even box elder, which is in the maple family, and even a big leaf maple, which grows on the west coast of the country, can be tapped to make maple syrup.
Okay, so is this a process of you take sort of a spigot and you tap it literally, you know, into the bark of the tree and then hook a pail on it? That's the picture I see usually.
Well, that is the basic operation, yes. Drilling a little hole into the tree allows the sap that is flowing inside to come out. Now, Native Americans a long time ago would slash the tree and then try to collect it with a bowl at the bottom. The colonists, when they arrived, had the benefit of metal tools. So instead, they would take an auger, drill a hole in, tap in a spigot of some sort. They might have carved out some sumac twig or elderberry and allowed that to flow out of that away from the trunk so you could collect it with a bucket. And then later on, metal spiles or spouts, as they are called, and buckets to collect it.
This does not sound like an expensive operation to pull off.
It is not, especially for the backyard hobbyist. First, if you've got the tree, you need a tool to drill it in there. And even just getting a plastic tubing from a hardware store or so, you can stuff it in that hole tightly and let it drain out into a milk jug, empty milk jug or bucket. And you collect a couple of gallons, and then it's time to just boil away all that extra water that is found naturally in the sap to where you're left with the sugar itself as syrup.
How much sap? You mentioned one tree could give you a couple of gallons of sap?
Yes, depending on the year, because the transition between winter and spring can be as long as, say, 8 weeks or more, or as short as, say, three. And the season actually begins when the days get up a above freezing into the 40s and 50s, but yet at night it falls below freezing. That is when the sap starts rising in the tree, and that's the time of the year then to start collecting. But the season ends as soon as the buds pop open at the twigs. At that point, the sap changes consistency, is no longer sweet, and the season is over. So depending on how long the season lasts, you may get a lot of chance to collect sap, or not so much.
Tim, thank you. I think we have a whole new hobby beginning.
Wonderful, wonderful.
Thank you, Tim.
You're welcome.
Tim Hurd is a naturalist and author of Maple Sugar from Sap to Syrup. Now, you can find information on making your own maple syrup and Tim's recipe for maple granola on the website splendidtable.org. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. Remember, you can reach us any way you want. You can join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or actually pick up the phone, 800-537-5252. Until next time, let me leave you with this thought from Laurie Cowan, who said, "A world without tomatoes is like a string quartet without violins." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Sarah Lear and Steve Cornier. Our managing producer is Sally Swift. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.